All right, we're going to finish up bone and joints, then go on to kidney. So here is the normal bone formation we call inchondral bone growth. It's simply what? Going from cartilage to bone. We talked about this last time in terms we start out as cartilaginous individuals in terms of skeleton going through different ossifications. And here you can see at the resting zone where you see the chondrocytes in a mononuclear habitation. Then you see a proliferation zone. Then the cells get larger. And then you see the calcified cartilage. And then it becomes ossification. You see where the cartilage becomes now bone in this process. And we think of this like the epiphyseal plates, which lengthens our bones. Let's talk about bone and joint diseases. Now that we've gone over normal bone. Developmental conditions. There are going to be problems with epiphyseal plates. We'll look at this leading to dwarfism, premature closure. You think of problems with the osteoblasts in terms of making collagen type 1, like osteogenesis imperfecta. We'll talk about fractures and what happens to bones when they fracture. It's a very common process that occurs with people. Talk about metabolic bone disease. The biggest one we're going to talk about is osteoporosis, which is a common condition where you have an imbalance between bone formation and bone reabsorption. The bone reabsorption is much easier to do than to formation, so if you have an imbalance, you get decreased bone density. We'll talk about infectious disease. It's not often that bones get infected, but they do. They become very problematic because it takes much more effort to treat them. Cysts and then tumors that are found in bone. The most common tumor found in the bone, like the lung, like the liver, is metastasis. Overall, the most common bone tumor is metastatic. But there are tumors that can arise from the cells within the bone, and we'll look at some examples. So developmental. As you can see, this is a form of dwarfism called achondrodysplasia. And by the term, A means without what? No. What's chondro? It would be aosteo if it was bone. But what happens is if you don't have that epiphyseal plate where you have that cartilage, then the long bones will not lengthen, and this is a form of dwarfism. So this is premature closure of the epiphyseal plate leading to a short stature. So an example of this. This is a problem of collagen type 1. Because that's the important structural protein found in bone. This is called osteogenesis imperfecta, where the collagen type 1 is abnormal and now makes that reinforcement bar within the calcium hydroxyapatite like brittle concrete. And this is a fetus you can see is multiple fractures to the bone. You can imagine trying to go through labor and delivery, you can basically cause many fractures to the newborn as they're coming out just because of the amount of intense pressure that's being placed on the fetus or the newborn. And then obviously you can provide them in terms of problems afterwards. There's different subtypes, but it involves collagen type 1. They get what is called blue sclera. Our sclera is the white of our eyes, and it's opaque. So when that's made of collagen type 1. So as this collagen type 1 is abnormal, what happens is it gets thinner and thinner. When light refracts off of it, it gives you a blue color. It's like non-fat milk. Next time you pour a glass of non-fat milk, look at the meniscus. You'll notice it has a sort of a bluish hue to it because of the decreased opacity because you don't have fat in it. This is what it looks like, a normal bone. You can see the cartilage at the top and this mineralization that's taking place. So this is what normal bone looks like, but this is what it looks like in osteogenesis imperfecta. You can see that this is the shattering of the ossification. You don't have any type 1 collagen in there, and it's like brittle concrete. It breaks apart. It's what reinforcement bar is important to make concrete stronger. Think of those when you see reinforcement bar as collagen type 1. And once it's defective, this is why you get the fractures, or what is called brittle bone disease. Sure. You see how it's mineralization? It's nice and organized. But when this collagen is abnormal, all you have is calcium hydroxyapatite. And look how it's just fragmented, like it's breaking apart, disintegrating before your very eyes. And you can see this has no ability to take on structural support or forces on that bone. Okay? post-traumatic. How many people have fractured a limb? All right, you're experts. You have to fracture to become an expert. So when you first fracture a bone, it feels painful, doesn't it? And why does it feel painful? It's a gross anatomy question. Nerves where in the bone? Where do you find the nerves? It's important to know, right? It's on the surface of the bone. The periosteum, the connective tissue, is innervated. So anything that causes it to stretch or rupture through, like a fracture, that's where you get the immediate bone pain. But once you fracture it, as long as you don't move it around and further bend it, then you will feel no pain. That's why if they got to realign the bone or put pins, and they're going to put you under general anesthesia, because it's very painful to line it up. And why is that important? If you have a disease like leukemia, which is a malignancy arising in the bone marrow, if those leukemic cells now go underneath the periosteum and stretch it, the patients will complain of bone pain. And you're wondering, why do they have bone pain if they don't have fractures? Is that means the periosteum is being irritated or expanded or stretched. And that's very important when they complain of bone pain. Be like disrupting it due to a fracture, or you have some type of process that's stretching it or invading into it, like leukemia, which is a malignancy of your bone marrow. Obviously, when you fracture it, you're going to cause bleeding, and you're going to go through the inflammatory process that we talked about. Acute inflammatory cells come in, macrophages, and then you'll stimulate bone formation, and then you'll get realignment and filling in the gap. And because of the mechanical forces that are placed on bone in the limbs, for example, then it'll line up fairly well, and it heals. So here's an example of a fracture of the fibula. Here you see the tibia, and here's the fibula. And you can see, you'd say, do I have to line this up correctly? You don't really, it's close enough that the bone and mechanical forces will realign it and heal. So especially when you're young, when you have fractures like this, it'll realignment because of the muscle compartments around it, and you don't have to go in there and put pins in it. It'll do it on its own accord. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. So what do we see? So in this diagram, you can see when you fracture a bone, the first thing you do is going to cause disruption of the tissue. You're going to bleed. You're going to have a hematoma. Now, macrophages, acute inflammatory cells and macrophages, like we talked about in acute inflammation or acute injury, it's going to come in and start organizing angiogenesis. Granulation tissue starts to form. The osteoclast will come in, and whatever fragmented bone there is, we're going to cause it to be reabsorbed. It becomes devitalized bone because it's disrupted. Then, how does bone form in a place where you think of, in this fracture, you actually produce cartilage in the callus, and this swelling is full of cartilage. So you have these progenitor cells that give rise to cartilage, and what does that cartilage become? This is inchondral bone growth in your fracture site. Then you'll also have osteoblasts that lay down from organic matrix and convert it to bone. That's intramembranous bone formation. So you have two forms of bone formation going on that are taking place. And what you notice about is the bone is now being realigned and forming in this callus, this swelling, and then they'll reconnect the cortical bone and trabecular bone, and you now heal the fracture. That's why they put on the cast. For how long did you have the cast on for those that fractured? Those who fracture, how long did you have it on?
6 weeks.
6 weeks to 8 weeks. Why? If you took it off earlier, what could happen clinically? Well, what could happen is you could produce a pseudoarthrosis, a secondary joint within the bone. Because if you now move that in this healing phase, it'll form a new joint right there. An odd joint, but you get a pseudoarthrosis. Because that process of keeping it on for 6 to 8 weeks, especially when you're young, is important to get that whole process of the bone being formed and becoming lamellar bone as its consequence. Okay? Here's what a fracture looks like histologically. Here you can see the fragmentation of the bone. Here's the fracture site. You can see there's displacement of the cortical bone here. And then this blue tissue is cartilage. You can see how cartilage is now forming new bone. So that's the inchondral bone growth. And then these fragments of devitalized bone will be taken up by the osteoclast, And then the osteoblasts are laying down with the vital bone and then realignment because of the mechanical forces. And it takes 6 to 8 weeks. Yes?
Did you say where the two forms of
chondral bone growth. Remember we taught going from cartilage to bone and then connective tissue to bone. Without cartilage is called intramembranous or oppositional bone growth. This is inchondral bone growth. Both of these components are taking place. This is the oppositional intramembranous growth. Here you see the osteoblasts lining up along, laying down collagen type 1. It'll eventually become mineralized, and that's oppositional bone growth that one sees. That's how you're able to regenerate bone at the site of the fracture in this case. Or let's say people have to insert bone and you don't want to take it from somewhere else. If you can't, they have bone banks where they take the bone and they autoclave it. They kill all the osteocytes in it and you basically have the housing, but the inhabitants are gone. If you need a segment of bone, you can put that devitalized autoclave bone into that place you need the bone and then secure it with screws. And what will happen is that devitalized bone will be, the osteoblast will come in, osteocytes, and remodel it and then reincorporate, turn over the bone, and now you have new bone because of using that dead bone. It's pretty amazing. Bone is pretty adaptable tissue. Yes. Yes, the question is, if you did a craniotomy, and you had to take the skull off for a while, and you could put it back on there, and then you, because they have what called burr holes, three holes to take it off, then what they would do is you would see it in oppositional bone growth occur. Plus, they put wires in there to help provide good placement and non-displacement wouldn't occur. The question is, will it fill up with complete bone? Typically not, but it'll be filled up with connective tissue, like scar tissue. So it'll be metabolic bone disease. We talk about osteoporosis. So what hormones would cause osteoporosis? A lack of or too much of what? Give me seven of them. Not enough estrogen. That's why you get postmenopausal osteoporosis. Too much hyperparathyroid being produced, hormone. You're going to reabsorb bone more than bone formation. If you don't have enough vitamin D, you can't reabsorb calcium. Absorb calcium in the gut, you have to get it from the bone. You will accelerate reabsorption, osteoporosis. What else? If you don't have enough growth hormone, that will stimulate more reabsorption than growth formation. Three more. If you don't have enough calcitonin, that's a problem. Okay? What's another one? Cortisol. If you have too much cortisol, it will cause reabsorption of bone. People on prednisone. You see what I've done? You can see bone. And what's another important factor that will accelerate osteoporosis is what? The lack of exercise. What does exercise do? What are you doing when you exercise your muscles? You're putting mechanical force on bone. So, where's the place, what occupation will accelerate osteoporosis? Astronauts, because there's no gravity, no muscle tension. You accelerate bone reabsorption relative to bone formation. So, if you're somebody who's immobilized in a bed, what do you have to worry about? Not only the breakdown of muscle, weakness, but also atrophy. But you also have to worry about osteoporosis as a consequence to this. So remember, mechanical forces are critical to bone metabolism. So menopause, you can see is decreased estrogen. There are increased cytokines from macrophages that will also inhibit bone formation. Increased osteoclastic activity. It's easier to break down bone to form it. So aging is one of the most common causes of osteoporosis because what happens to your tissues. What happens to your muscle mass as you age? It atrophies. So then what happens to muscle tension? on bone. Decreases. So you can lead to osteoporosis. Can elderly men get osteoporosis? Absolutely. Because they have less testosterone. If they're not using their muscle, they can get... I've seen people, males, fracture their pelvis because of severe osteoporosis, and they're in their 80s. So this is, you have to think of mechanical forces and those hormones, and if there's important things that can inhibit. And one of the things that can inhibit is smoking. Smoking is anti-estrogenic. So if you're female and postmenopausal and smoking, not a good idea, by the way. Doesn't matter what you smoke either. Okay. So it's decreased bone mass or density. So here is a common place where you get fractures in people that are older who have osteoporosis. Here are the vertebral bodies. What's the predominant bone that we see here? Cortical bone or trabecular bone? Trabecular bone, because the vertebral bodies have to disseminate force per unit area to distribute the pressure. But now what happens if you cause decreased bone density? What's happened to this one? A compression fracture. Basically, you're like an accordion smashing down. I've seen it where the intervertebral discs now touch one another because the vertebral body is completely gone because of compression fracture. They tend to be painless, but if they're at the right angle, they could cause spinal nerve pressure on it and cause pain. But they usually are silent. But that's a compression fracture. Another place you get it, we talked about, is the neck of the femur. Person falls down, they get a hip fracture. That's where they're gonna, or the pelvis. Where's the other place? When you fall down, what's the first response you do? You put your hand out, don't you? And what bone gets ruptured, it gets fractured, is the distal radius. And that's called Colles fracture. Colles fracture is because what do you have at the end of the bone? A lot of? What type of bone? Cortical bone or trabecular bone? Trabecular. And that's where you see the fractures, where you have a lot of trabecular bone because of the disseminating the mass, or dispersing it, I should say. This is what normal bone looks like. You can see the this happens to be vertebral bone. Here's the cortex, but you see the nice 90-degree angles of trabecular bone or spongiform bone. This is what it looks to be osteoporotic. What do you notice about the organization of the bone? It's lost. It lost that 90 degrees. What do you notice about the thickness of the trabecular bone? Thinner or thicker? Thinner. So what's the ability it's going to have now? Fractures very easily. It's structurally unstable. That's how you have to think about it. Here's another stain to look at it. This is a stain that's looking at the bone itself. This is normal bone. The green is looking at the mineral component. Orange will be the organic component, like collagen type 1. Here's a patient who has what is called osteomalacia. What does malacia mean? Soft. This is a problem of vitamin D deficiency. When you have it in children or infants, what do we call it? Rickets. But in adults like you and I, you get osteomalacia because the green is representing, you see less of it here because the mineral component is gone, but you still have the organic component. And it's showing you the difference between osteomalacia and osteoporosis. Osteoporosis is affecting both components of bone, the mineral component and the organic component. That's why it's decreased bone density. This is only one component, and that's the mineral component. We call it osteomalacia. And here's what osteoporosis looks like. You can see that trabecular bone is much thinner. Both the organic and inorganic components are diminished. How do you prevent osteoporosis? How do you prevent it? Now that we know what causes it, what would you do? How would you prevent it in you? Exercise. All your life? Walk. Forget about the elevators and escalators. What else would you do? You would have a good diet and make sure you get vitamin D if you're deficient. Make sure you have calcium in your diet because you want to make sure that you have all the components. So you don't want the body to have to use the calcium from your bone and accelerate osteoporosis. So those are the basic things you need to do in order to prevent it. Or if you're a female, depending upon if you have a history, a family history of osteoporosis, you may think about hormonal replacement therapy, estrogen. So there's all sorts of things that can do to look at this, okay? Any questions about osteoporosis? Yes. Well, because it's osteoblasts, I mean, the osteoclasts are breaking down the entire component of bone, both the mineral and the organic. Collagen type 1. Remember, remember the slide I showed you last week? 2/3 of your bone is made of what? Calcium hydroxyapatite. The 23%, or less than 1/4, slightly, is the organic component, the collagen. So when you have more osteoclastic activity, you're reabsorbing both components. Versus in osteomalacia, I need calcium, I'll keep the organic, but I'll release the calcium hydroxyapatite, break that down because of the parathyroid hormone, accelerating release. Remember, 99% of your calcium stored where in the body? Bone. You got to always remember that. It's a very important detail. And so if there's an increased need of calcium in the body, or you have something that causes it to increase the release of calcium, you can now accelerate osteoporosis. This is scurvy. And here is normal bone, and scurvy is a problem of vitamin C deficiency, and it affects the cross-linking of collagen. So if you can't cross-link collagen molecule, the three polypeptides, what happens to its structural strength? Diminished. And so this is inchondral bone growth. You see the cartilage? There's the bone. Now when you have scurvy, what do you notice? When you get down to the bone, it doesn't look like normal bone anymore, does it? Just like osteogenesis imperfecta. That was a collagen type 1 molecule problem. This is also collagen type 1, but there's a lack of cross-linking. So it makes it structurally unstable. And that's why you get pathologic fractures with scurvy. What group of people in the United States do you think has the highest risk for developing scurvy today in the United States? What group of people that you'll be working with? Huh? What group of people? Huh? Come on, what group of people? Because you're going to become one of the largest populations. The what? What group of people? The elderly. And why? Because they're on fixed incomes. So what are they? Remember we talked about this. What are they going to pay for, food or rent first? What do you think they're going to pay first? Rent. So what do you think the quality of food and the type of food they're going to get? Diminished. And that's a problem. And so you always have to think of it. Now, if you have child abuse, that's another way you can get it in the United States. If 1 out of every 7 children in the United States is in poverty, 1 out of every 7 child is in poverty in the United States, they're also at risk as well of not getting enough nutrition. That's why the federal free lunch program is to make sure they get access to it. But there's no free lunch or meal for elderly. So it's important to understand the demographics and economics of society, because the groups of patients, you're understanding why you're seeing them coming to you at various points. So this becomes important. So infectious bone diseases. Infection of the skin is more common than bone infections, but the Staphylococcus aureus, which is a bacteria that's highly pyogenic, we talked about it when it causes pneumonia, it also causes skin infections, but also can go to your bone. And you can imagine trying to treat osteomyelitis is very difficult because it's very difficult to get a high enough antibiotic therapeutic level in the blood to treat it. So what do they have to go in there sometimes? Is scrape out the bone. Oh, yeah. To scrape out the pus, to decrease the infectious load, and then provide antibiotics. And it can be very difficult to treat. So this is acute osteomyelitis. You can see the pus in the bone marrow. This is what you're going to see is acute inflammatory cells coming in, and so the lytic enzymes are being released, like elastase and collagenase, especially collagenase, can make the bone structurally weaker, and like any inflammatory process in any tissue, destroying it. This is a chronic form of osteomyelitis due to tuberculosis. TB can get to your bones, and hematogenous, we talked about TB, and TB is going to form what type of inflammation, acute or chronic? Chronic, what type of chronic? You had it on the exam and the midterm. What type of necrosis do you get? And what type of form of chronic inflammation? Caseation. And what's the form of inflammation? Chronic. What do we call that very specific type of inflammation and chronic that's specific to TB? Granulomas. Very good. I know you would still remember that. So granulomatous inflammation. How long do macrophages live? 60 to 120 days. So if you're living there in that bone, what are you releasing? All these lytic enzymes. So what are you going to do to the bone? Destroy it. And here's the spine. This is a patient who has Pott's disease. And is that the normal angle of your sacrum to your lumbar? It isn't. And this is what it does. It basically melts the bone away. It's like pouring battery acid into the bone and destroying it. And that's what granulomas do. So it's worse to get chronic osteomyelitis as a consequence of an infectious disease. It's going to prolong the inflammatory process of chronic inflammation. But that's what it looks like. Okay? Yes?
Is most common to affect the spine, or will you see it in other bones as well?
The question is, can it occur in other bones? Yes, but this is one of the most common, especially because it's hematogenous spread, and at the time, and you tend to see this in adults, you have more of your red marrow wear in your axial skeleton. It can occur in other bones, but this is the classic that can occur. And you can see it's a very destructive osteomyelitis. And it can be very hard to treat, very difficult. Here is another cause of osteomyelitis is, in this part of the country, is coccidiomycosis, San Joaquin Valley fever. It can go from your lungs, like TB, and disseminate to bone. This happens to be in bone, causing a chronic osteomyelitis. This can be very difficult to treat because you have to use systemic antifungal medications, which can cause a lot of side effects. Bone tumors. The most common tumor found in the bone is, not primary, but metastasis. You think of breast, lung, GI are very common. Malignant melanoma from the skin likes to metastasize the bone. So people may come in with a pathologic fracture. They did very minor trauma or just got up the wrong way and they snapped their bone, and it can be as a presentation of a bone tumor with its primary metastatic. So how do we make the diagnosis of a bone tumor? First, we have to get a good clinical history. Second is what bone is involved. So the anatomy becomes very important. We want to know whether it's the femur or not. And then we want it like in a long bone, or is it in your scapula, or is it in your rib? And what part of the bone? Is it at the metaphysis? Is it at the epiphysis, the diaphysis? So certain bone tumors occur at different regions, in particular bone, and the different regions within that bone. And this becomes very important. The most common tumor you see in adolescence occurs around the knee at the metaphysis, and that is osteogenesis sarcoma. Sorry, I'm thinking about collagen defect, and I'll show you that. X-ray findings are critical, but how do you make the diagnosis of a tumor is? Biopsy. And that's how you make the diagnosis of a bone tumor. You have to have these pieces of information. They're very age-dependent. They're dependent upon what bone, what part of the bone, the X-ray findings, and ultimately the biopsy. So here is a benign tumor of bone. And here we see it at the epiphysis of the fibula, the proximal part, because here's the proximal portion of the tibia. And in means what? Inside. And it's made of what type of tissue? Cartilage. Benign or malignant? Benign. If it was malignant, what would you call it? Chondrosarcoma. So here we have a well circumscribed, and what do you notice about its radiolucency? It's greater because cartilage is less dense than bone, and you can see it has a very sharp border around it. This is classic for it. When you look at it grossly, here you can see this cartilaginous tissue. Here's the fatty bone marrow in the long bone. So you can see it's well circumscribed. It hasn't gone through the cortical bone. Here you see an X-ray showing you there's some bone in here, but most of it's cartilage. And then when you look at it microscopically, you can see it's well circumscribed. But if this was malignant, what would it be doing to show it's malignant? Invasion. And you don't see that. So this is a benign inchondral bone tumor. Okay. Here's what it looks like histologically. Here are the chondroblasts that's forming the collagen. You see there's the cartilage, and you see there's not a lot of cells. They have no pleomorphism. Now, this is the opposite, is chondrosarcoma. This occurs in older people, middle age, usually around the shoulder girdle, the pelvic girdle, or in the jaw area. They don't metastasize, but they're expanding, get quite large. You can see it's invading into the surrounding tissue. And it has that whitish cartilaginous appearance to it. When you look at it microscopically, what do you notice about the number of cells compared to the benign? Increase. What do you notice about their size and shape? They're pleomorphic. Those characteristics we define as malignant. And you can see they look bizarre looking, so this is what a malignant cartilaginous tumor looks like. This is the most common primary tumor of the bone, and it tends to occur in adolescence, whether it's boys or girls. Why? Because what happens to your bones when you're in your going through puberty? You have a lot of lengthening going on, because what tells me the age of this patient? What's that white line there? That's the epithelial plate telling me this is an adolescent, and it's not an adult. If I looked at if we took a cross-section of your femur, what would you expect to find? Would you find an epithelial plate? They're all gone. Okay? So if this is occurring at the metaphysis, here you see a tumor that's invading and going out. So you can see it's the 60% of these tumors occur where? In the knee. This is a classic place. Either the proximal portion of the tibia or the distal portion of the femur. Another place you can see it in, about 15%, is in the proximal portion of the femur or within the pelvis itself. Another place that grows is the proximal humerus. And then if you looked at photographs of your face before puberty and after, you'll notice bones have also grown. And that's another place you can get about 8% is osteogenesis sarcoma in your mandible and maxilla is an issue. Just take a picture of just look at your family album, and you'll notice that your face has gotten bigger from that period of time because you've got bone growth in your skull. Yes.
Is there a reason why it's in those areas?
Yes. Well, because that's where do you lengthen your bones at? From producing all that inchondral bone growth in the metaphysis as it goes from cartilage to bone. So it's the metaphysis. The epiphysis up here, the metaphysis is where you have all these osteoblastic activity.
Compared to like other parts of the body, like why aren't you seeing it in the forearm, hands?
Because they don't lengthen as much. And you have less osteoblasts. So remember, if the more cells are dividing, what happens to mutation rates? That's why. Does that make sense? Could you get it in those other places? Sure. But the likelihood of seeing it is very low. Now, what's another time you can get osteogenic sarcoma of the bone is secondary conditions. If you had radiation to your bone, for example, that could cause mutations in your osteoblasts, lead to secondary osteogenic sarcoma of the bone. If you had somebody who had chronic osteomyelitis for years, you couldn't treat it because those osteoblasts are constantly being dividing, mutation rate goes up, you can get osteogenic sarcoma arising in chronic osteomyelitis, by the way, because the increased turnover of osteoblasts. What's another disease that can cause secondary osteogenic sarcoma of the bone? Is Paget's disease of the bone. It's osteitis deformans, and this is a imbalance between osteoblasts and osteoclasts, and because of that, they have an increased osteoblastic activity, and you can get secondary osteogenic sarcoma of the bone as well. This is primary. It's a typically normal individual growing, and they have no other conditions, versus secondary, some other predisposing factor is leading to it. Okay? This is what malignant osteoblasts look like, because this is a problem of osteoblastic activity. It's trying to make malignant bone, all these spindle-shaped cells around this bone that's abnormal. So this is a tumor of osteoblasts. Okay. What's the most common tumor found in the bone is metastasis. This is from a 37-year-old woman who had breast cancer metastasized to her spine. And when you see bone tumor, this is, you see they're multiple. And take a look at that one up at the left, right there. I just took my finger and popped it right out. Now, what happened to the bone? It's been destroyed, hasn't it? Most tumors that go to bone are osteolytic. So what happens to the structural integrity now of that bone? Goes down. Now you can get spinal cord compression and paralysis because of the fracture that will now take place. What's a metastatic tumor to bone that is osteoblastic? Is prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is very common. It tends to go to bone and produce an osteoblastic response and not an osteolytic like this. Okay? Let's go to joints as we finish this up. We're going to talk about three joint diseases. They're very common. One is degenerative arthritis or degenerative joint disease. Other one is an autoimmune disease, hypersensory reaction 4 and 3. This involves rheumatoid arthritis. Then we have a metabolic problem that you'll see in patients is a problem of uric acid accumulation in tissues. And this is, you think of gout. And we'll talk about the manifestations and why you get the manifestations. And then infective arthritis, unless you have a direct wound to the joint or you have osteomyelitis that gets into the joint, typically what gets to the joint are going to be pathogens like Staphylococcus aureus, but one that's a venereal disease is gonorrhea. If you don't treat it, it can disseminate and go directly to your joints and produce an acute arthritis or infectious arthritis. There's proliferative neoplasm, very uncommon. So let's go to degenerative joint disease. What group of people in the United States have the greatest likelihood of getting degenerative joint disease? In adults. What condition? And when you think of degenerative joint disease, it's basically taking the ends of your bones, the articulating cartilage, and rubbing against it over a period of time. And you destroy the articulating cartilage. So when you think of degenerative joint disease, what are you destroying in the joint? The cartilage, the articulating cartilage. So what group of people do you think has the highest likelihood of getting it? What group of people? Yeah, but what group of people have the highest risk for developing OA? No. What would cause you? What do we have in our joints? Synovial joints. We have what in it? We have synovial fluid. What would cause that? What condition would cause that cartilage now to rub against if you still had fluid that's non-compressible? Starts with an O. Obesity. Obese people. What do you think of that massive weight? What is it going to do to your joints? It's going to cause this grinding. Because of that increased weight. Do people who are obese get osteoporosis? Why not? There's two reasons. What's the mechanical force now when you have somebody obese on their bones compared to somebody who's very thin? Less or greater? So that'll keep a balance. Also, when you're obese, you can get hyperestrogenism. You get estrone to estradiol. So that could be an anti-osteoporotic. I wouldn't promote obesity as a way of getting rid of osteoporosis because you'll get degenerative joint disease as a consequence. So obesity, because you can think of joints like the hip, and here you see the acetabulum, and here you see the head of the femur, and there's very little space. You notice there's very little space between there that tells you what's been destroyed. The articulating cartilage, that's right. And so bone is now rubbing against bone, and that's not a good idea. Here's what it looks like at the femoral head because it's a weight-bearing joint. It tends to be weight-bearing and asymmetrical. Here you can see the cartilage kind of has a pitted surface. It would be nice and smooth. And you see it's shiny right here? This is polished bone now. That's grinding your joint like this against bone. Now that cartilage against cartilage and you wear it out. It's like wearing out your brakes. Then you can get bony reaction or exostoses at the edge of the bone that further deforms the joint. If we do a cross-section through the hip, here's the normally articulating cartilage. What do you notice about the articulating cartilage up there where the arrow is pointing? Do you see any articulating cartilage? No, because it's bone grinding on bone now. Is this reversible? No. So what's the only treatment? Hip transplants. Hip replacements. You become a bionic person. That's what you... It's usually going to be the knees or the hips. Sometimes both. So here you can see the cartilage. You don't see much. It's a misnomer called OA because do you see any inflammatory cells here? Yay or nay? No. So that's why degenerative joint disease is a better name for it. Because you're destroying the... Here's the articulating cartilage. Instead of being chondrocytes by themselves, they're now cohabiting. And you can see there's fissures, and you can see how the thickness of the cartilage as it's being destroyed becomes down to subchondral bone. This is subchondral bone, the bone right underneath the articulating cartilage. So that's why once you wear through that cartilage, now it's bone rubbing against bone as a consequence to this. So what are the groups of people? Repetitive use of joints. On a baseball team, what two players have the highest risk for degenerative joint disease on a baseball team? The catcher. They're always going up and down on their knees. They get a lot of osteoarthritis. What's the other person? The pitcher. You can imagine throwing repetitively and using that arm and winding up and using those joints. Anybody who's contractors that are doing constant repetitive motion, hammering, for example. So using seamstresses, they're working and using their hands all the time over a period of time can wear it out. So you can wear out joints based on overusage of it. That's, yes.
How long does it usually take until somebody feels the effects?
How long it take? That's a great question. I can't give you a specific time. It depends upon, again, how you're using that joint, how often, the frequency, and what joints are involved. And so, for example, you see when you see little kids starting playing soccer at 4 and 5, and they play it all the way until they're teenagers, they get a lot of bone or joint problems, don't they? So they, if you start out young, you can start out too young playing, you can get damage to the knees. So it depends on when you start, what the repetitive nature. Golfers, what are they always doing? So what joints do you think they would go? Their elbows, their shoulders, their hips. So repetitive use. Joints are not... going to be there forever. All biological tissues break down. Can you over-exercise? What if you exercise every day, 6 hours a day for 7 days a week? Do you think your joints would take a hit? Oh, yeah. Moderation is the key. This is an interesting story. This is from a patient who has syphilis. This is their knee opened up. This is extreme sore. This is an extreme example. I want to show you how bad it can get. So what you're looking at, here's the left foot, looking down here to the left. The thigh is up here. And what we have, what we opened up here is the distal part of the femur. And you see these white structures here? These are called loose bodies or joint mice. They, depending upon the orthopods, how they call it. And what it is, remember, cartilage does not need blood supply, right? It gets its nutrition by diffusion. So what can happen as you wear out the joint, pieces of the cartilage now break off and now float in your synovial fluid or get embedded in the wall. And it feels like a bag of gravel when you start playing, or a bag of marbles. When you start playing with the joint, you feel these little bodies in there. You say, what's this? It's cartilage. So how does syphilis lead to this? One of the important characteristics of a joint, as you know, is proprioception. When I move my joint, when I'm looking over here, I know that my joint is going to be aligned when I move it here. The proprioception is in the posterior column of your spine. And what happens in tertiary syphilis, you get destruction called tibialis dorsalis of the posterior column of your spine, And now you lose proprioception. Now when I move the joint will be moving like this. And like the front wheels of your car, if they're malaligned, what happens to your tires is a function of time if there's not properly alignment, just like articulating cartilage. So proprioception is critical to joint function, and that can lead now, this is a person that had a really bad proprioception going to their knee joint, and now they got severe degenerative joint disease and got this loose bodies. And here's polished bone. So that's how you could do it. What's a common disease you'll see that can lead to degenerative joint disease is diabetes mellitus. Because it causes sensory neuropathy, it can also affect proprioception to joints if it's severe enough. So proprioception is also critical for the alignment of the joint to make sure that the joint is being moved in the right direction it's supposed to. Any questions about degenerative joint disease? Another one is rheumatoid arthritis. What does rheum mean? What does rheum mean when you say rheumatology, rheumatism? It means joints. So this is joint. Right? Like joint, because it's inflammation of the joint. You have to say it twice. Okay? This is autoimmune disease. And what sex tends to get this? Females. And it's very common. So here's the pathogenesis. You have some type of self-antigen that now stimulates CD4 helper cells to recruit with gamma interferon, the cytokines, macrophages. The macrophages come in and release cytokines like TNF and IL-1. This will stimulate the fibroblasts and the synovial cells to proliferate. And you get release of inflammatory cells, collagenase and other elastase and other extracellular matrix molecules. And what happens in the joint capsule, you get this tissue, this inflamed granulation tissue go over the surface of the joint surface. We call this pannus. What does pannus look like when you have Thanksgiving dinner this Thursday? Or next Thursday, I should say. This Thursday. When you put that tablecloth on, you've put a pannus on the table. Pannus means cloth. So you're covering the joint space with a cloth of inflamed granulation tissue, and now you destroy the articulating cartilage, and now you fuse the joint, now you have an ankylotic joint, or fused joint. What can also is that these patients make abnormal antibodies called rheumatoid factor, typically IgG or IgM, and you can make antibodies to the antibody, and now you have an immunocomplex gets formed in different parts of the body or in the joint, and that activates complement and destroys the joint as well. Okay. So here's the example of the joint. You can see it's being destroyed by this pannus formation going into it, because you have lytic enzymes destroying the articulating cartilage in the synovial joint, and now this can now fuse, and now you have an ankylotic joint. That's why you take steroids or anti-inflammatory drugs or anti-TNF drugs to interfere with this process of damage to your articulating cartilage. So this is what it looks like grossly. This happens to be the knee. What bone is this? Patella. This is the articulating surface of the tibia. Here's the articulating surface of the distal femur. And here's the normal cartilage, but then you see this pannus. See this reddish tissue because it has blood vessels in it? It looks like it's being eaten away like battery acid released on these proteolytic enzymes into the joint. And now this joint can now fuse and it becomes non-functional. When you look at it microscopically, here's the capsule of the joint. We see all these lymphocytes. These are synovial cells. Normally you have one single layer of synovial cells in a joint. So we call this a chronic proliferative synovitis. Then here's what the pannus looks like. Here you see the cartilage. Here's the subchondral bone. And you see this cloth-like inflammatory process called pannus going over the surface and destroying the joint, articulating surface, because you see sort of these pits into the cartilage and destroying it. Everyone see? That's why they call it pannus. So cloth means pannus. 25% of these patients can get systemic manifestations of rheumatoid arthritis. One is in the skin here, showing you these rheumatoid nodules, the extensor surface of the elbow, for example, the knees. They become symmetrical in its distribution. And you can get it in the lungs. You can get rheumatoid nodules or destruction to the lungs, the heart. So when you think of rheumatoid arthritis, it is a systemic disease, not just joints. Any question about rheumatoid arthritis? On that note, we'll take a break, come back, finish up this, and go on to the kidney. This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.